Hi, this is Tom, and you're listening to Stempunk. Today's episode is an interview with James O'Hanlon from Macquarie University. He's a scientist, science communicator, looking into animal behaviour, ecology, evolution. But I'll let Shane do the introduction. Before we get into the interview, I just wanted to mention our live STEM quiz event for Science Week. This is really exciting. We're going to be holding a live Stempunk quiz type event, sort of like Spicks and Specks versus Rock Quiz, but with more science, where we'll be having myself as a host, Shane and Christy as two team captains, Carolyn Hogg from Sydney University, who looks into Tasmanian devils and face tumours and all that sort of interesting stuff, and Fred Watson, astronomer and science communicator Fred Watson. It's going to be really exciting. There's heaps of fun questions, heaps of good times. We'll also have some audience participation, some prizes for the audience. It's going to be good. The STEM quiz or Stempunk quiz will be held at Wayward Breweries in Annandale in Sydney from 6:30 to 8 p.m. On Tuesday the 16th of August, which is in Science Week. It's part of the Sydney Science Festival and also being supported by National Science Week. Really, really fun. I hope you guys can make it. But until then, get into this interview that Shane did with James.
So welcome back on Stempunk Podcasting. I'm one of the Stempunks, Shane Hanks, and here with me is Dr. James O'Hanlon. How's it going?
Going great, Shane. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, James. Fantastic. On to a great start. Yeah. Here we go. Okay, so first question. We always ask this of all our guests. What does STEM mean to you?
STEM is the way I think that people can justify their existence. If you think about science, technology, engineering, mathematics, you're either creating something that didn't exist before, or you're discovering something that nobody knew before. And if you think about whenever you go out and you meet new people, every now and again you just come across someone who is just a bit of a lump. You know, they're lovely and articulate and intelligent people, but you ask them what they do and what they're into, and they just kind of go, oh, I like watching The Bachelor and, hanging out with my friends, stuff. And you just realize that this adorable, lovely person is just a scotch fillet. They're just sitting there and they're just consuming the world around them, and they're not actually contributing anything. And I don't know about you, but I just feel this, I feel compelled to either create something and contribute it to the world, or to discover something that nobody knew before. And the things that I discover as a scientist may be just a little tiny piece of a much, much larger puzzle, but that's a little piece that wouldn't have been there if I didn't exist in the first place.
And so you're saying it gives meaning to your life and other people's lives as well?
Yes, and that's why I think everybody should care about it and should be involved in it.
Fantastic.
Wow. So that's and I think that's why I often put the A in STEM as well and make it STEAM, because art is that same thing. It's creating something that wasn't there before. And I think the technology and the engineering and the arts, that's the creative side of it. And that's where you're taking technology and tools that are available to us and shaping the world around us. And with all the focus that's been on STEM and STEAM lately in the media and policy and pop culture, I think there's been a huge focus on that creating side of it. Everybody's talking about maker spaces and digital literacy and all that stuff. And I'm trying to, in my own work, push the other side of it, the exploratory side of it, where you're discovering new things and creating knowledge and exploring.
Fantastic. So let's talk more about you.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about your background?
How far do you want me to go back?
When you were born.
I was born in Northern Ireland. 1984.
Seriously?
Yeah. That's why I have this strange accent.
Of course. Yeah. I did pick up on that. No.
Apologies to the listeners.
No, it's a great accent.
Thank you.
Fantastic. So let's fast forward a bit.
Yeah.
Let's say university.
Yeah.
Yeah. So which university you went straight out of high school?
Yes. And I did a degree in marine biology. Pretty much just because I thought it'd get me chicks. I don't know.
I want to be a marine biologist.
I mean, yeah, that's why I
actually do a marine biology degree. It's the classic three, isn't it? Like, study dinosaurs, marine biology, or astronaut.
Yeah, it didn't work, just for anyone thinking of doing the same thing.
It's good to know.
In high school, I was very much an arty person. I played a lot of music, and I guess music was my number one subject, and my HSE preferences, I had music and communications and those sorts of things at the top of my preferences list. And then towards the end of school, I started feeling like I should be sensible, and I thought, I don't need a degree to be a struggling artist. I can just do that on the side. I'll go and get a proper degree, which means that I got a science degree, and it means I'm just a struggling scientist instead of a struggling artist. But I think, I'd always had an interest in animals, and I started scuba diving when I was a teenager. I had an uncle who was a dive master and a dive instructor, and he introduced me to that world, and so it was really a natural progression that way. But it really wasn't until I was in university that I really discovered how much I enjoyed science. I wasn't blessed with the most amazing science teachers in high school. I guess I just had that an interest for the natural world. And it was once I was in university and I was learning from experts in the field and hearing their stories, it really opened up the world of possibilities to me.
Hmm. So which university did you graduate from?
Macquarie. I've been hanging around Macquarie for a long time. And,
and you're back here now.
I keep leaving and then I keep coming back and, try and diversify my CV, but Macquarie keeps offering to pay me, so I can't really say no.
Yeah, struggling scientists and all. So you did your undergraduate degree here, combined with honours, I take it?
I went straight into Masters.
Oh, straight into Masters.
And that came about just because I was volunteering in a lab here at Macquarie and just sort of made friends in the lab there and decided that I wanted to work with these guys. And that wasn't in a marine biology field at all. That they were a behavioral ecology group that did insect and spider work. And I started volunteering with a great guy called Dr. Greg Hullwell, who is an expert in praying mantis genitalia. Which is a fascinating field.
All right, we have to go there now. What's involved in looking at praying mantis genitalia?
Well, something, if you start talking to zoologists, genitals come up a lot. And you can quote me on that.
Probably will. Genitals come up a lot. Okay. Yes.
Well, so biology is all about reproduction.
And yes.
The better you are at reproducing, the more genes you pass on to the next generation. And genitals are directly involved in reproduction. So there's actually a lot of selection on organisms to have optimally performing genitals. And when you start to look at things like insects, their genitals are bizarre. They have all these amazing adaptations to help them pass their genes on to the next generation. It's not just about transferring sperm, it's about transferring the most sperm or transferring sperm into a place within the female where it's more likely to fertilize their eggs. There are insects that have little appendages on their genitals to scrape out sperm that are already inside the female. There are animals who rip their genitals off and leave it inside the female so she can't mate with any other males. It's a very big and exciting field in zoology.
So is this what you studied in Masters?
No, so I looked at praying mantises still, but I was looking at their natural ecology, and it involved lots of traveling around the tropics of Australia, so up in far north Queensland, and I was looking at these little tiny brown mantises that are just everywhere. If you're up in Queensland, go to a national park or a picnic area, and sort of anywhere north of Townsville, really, and look along tree trunks, and just sort of rub your hand up and down the tree trunks, and if you see a little brown flash move, it might be one of these little tree-running mantises. Yeah. And we really started studying them because they're everywhere, but we knew nothing about them. They're just this mysterious little creature, and I was just sort of looking at what sort of habitats they're in, what affects their abundance, you know, how do they interact behaviorally. It was a very exploratory research project.
So from your master's straight into a PhD?
Or? Yeah, so I just sort of rode that wave. You always have these plans to go off and do other things. You know, when I finished my degree, I thought, you know, I decided I was going to go teach English in Japan for a year, because that seemed to be the thing that people did.
Yes.
So I started making applications to do that, and that was just taking a while, and then I got offered the master's program, so I thought, all right, may as well just do that. And then after my master's, I was going to take a break from research, I was going to go off and work somewhere, and I couldn't find a job, because science can be hard to find a job in sometimes, and then I got offered a scholarship to do a PhD, so...
Fantastic.
You just keep riding that way.
Yep. How different was your research from PhD to master's?
So still in praying mantises, so I'm kind of become the praying mantis guy,
okay.
But conceptually it was very different. And my PhD was on a fantastic little animal called the orchid mantis, and that's really where it all started. And when I was doing my master's, I was reading about praying mantises and all these different types of praying mantises, and I kept coming across stories of this one critter called the orchid mantis, and it is almost a mythological beast, the way people talk about it. It's a predatory insect, but it looks like a flower.
Oh, wow. So okay.
It's bright white or pink, these big lobes on its legs that look like flower petals, and I was reading all these articles that said it looks like a flower and it lures in bees and eats them. You know, the bees think it's a flower and fly towards it. And I thought, that's pretty amazing.
It's kind of like a Venus flytrap in that sense, but
yeah.
It's an animal rather than a flower.
Yeah. And I thought that was a really cool story and I wanted to find out more about it. And so I went looking for the research papers that showed that it was actually luring in bees, and it turns out there was nothing. It was just this idea floating around. And the more and more I looked into it, I realized that there was this amazing natural history story about an animal that mimics a flower. And as far as we know, it was just a myth. There was actually no evidence to support it. It's in one of Richard Dawkins' books, you know, this supposed fact that they're a flower mimic and that nobody had ever studied. And so I kind of just decided that I wanted to be that guy. I want to debunk this myth. And it all started from there, really, yeah.
And did you study the actual praying mantis in its natural environment?
Or? Yeah, so it's only found in Southeast Asia. So I was still based here in Sydney, but did lots of field trips up to Peninsular Malaysia. And that was they're an impossible animal to find. They're stupidly rare. So it's not an easy thing just saying, I'm going to go find some orchid mantis. Yeah. But yeah, we went out into the forest and we were able to observe really for the first time that, yeah, bees actually do fly straight towards these praying mantises as if they're going to visit a flower. And if the mantis is hungry, they'll just nab it and eat it. So it works. This looking like a flower is a really, really effective way of luring in prey items for this mantis.
Wow, that's incredible. Did you... I guess sweep the biological community off their feet with that.
Oh yeah,
finding.
Yeah, it was great. Everybody loved it. No, it is. It was a really cool natural history story, and I published that 3 years ago now. And every so often, I'll still get a phone call out of the blue from someone that's writing an article for a popular science magazine or something that just want to talk about this cool natural history story, because it's, as far as we know, the only animal on the planet that mimics a flower.
Oh, wow.
And not only does it lure in bees and eat them, but it seems to be more effective at luring in bees than real flowers. So it's bigger and it's brighter and it's just like a super attractive stimulus for...
You got video bees. Footage of this?
Yes. The BBC even made a little...
So you get credit with that?
I'm on it.
Oh, you're on BBC.
They flew me out sometime last year. Yeah. No, 2014, whatever year it was. Made a little 5-minute segment about the orchid mantis, and they got some amazing high-speed footage at like 1,000 frames a second of bees being nabbed out of midair by these mantises. So, yeah.
That's incredible. So you got your bit of media splash then.
Yeah.
So you're no stranger to science communication, mm-hmm. right? In fact, when we first met, you were working at the Australian Museum.
Yeah.
So can you describe what you did there?
So I was part of the... We called it the science communication team at the time. I think now it's called the science engagement and events something. But essentially, as part of the team that organizes the Australian Museum Science Festival that happens every National Science Week, and also lots of little outreach events and school holiday programs. And it was really nice to step away from research for a bit and do some just sort of devoted communication and outreach and work somewhere else for a while. And yeah, I think we met because you were one of the presenters at the Science Festival in the UNSW physics booth, and you were doing the Star Lab. Mm-hmm. And so I saw lots of your communicating, but you probably just saw me running around.
Yeah, you were taking photographs.
Logistics. I was a photo guy, wasn't I? Yeah.
So you're doing a bit of media stuff, I take it. And but you also did, you helped get some presenters together as well, didn't you? Or was it more just a person running around making sure things getting done?
Yeah, so the Science Festival recruits in tons of different organizations. All the different universities have people presenting, and there's workshops on, and there's talks, and there's experimental displays and all sorts of things. So it's sort of my job to be a bit of a liaison between the museum and all these different presenters and bring them all in and make sure they're being looked after and we're able to present their best stuff.
Hmm. So do you think it's a good balance to have for a scientist or a researcher such as yourself to be able to communicate with the public?
Yes, it's a responsibility. It's not just a good combination. I think the reason that we do science is for the betterment of humanity. Yeah. I mean, on a personal level, we do it because we enjoy it, and it's totally selfish. But the way we justify people paying us to do these things is because it contributes to the society we live in. And for me, I've never really seen doing science and communicating science as two separate things. I've always done them simultaneously from the moment I started doing research. During my master's, I was also teaching undergraduate units, and the way that being a practicing researcher and a teacher complements each other is just amazing. If I just did research, all I would be doing is reading articles that immediately relate to whatever I'm studying at that point in time. But if I'm doing teaching at the same time, I've got to go out and teach myself all the things that I then have to communicate to others. So it makes me a much more well-rounded scientist and offers perspectives on my own work that I otherwise wouldn't have.
So what do you think is one of the biggest sort of problems in sort of communicating an idea to, say, a non-scientist?
What, problems for the people doing it or problems...
Well, just any challenges, in general. how the person's receiving the information or how you prepare yourself and telling the information, just some insights into that form of communication, I guess, in your experience.
Well, I think broadly a big problem with communication at the moment is lots of it's done by journalists,
okay,
which are great communicators, but science comes second with them. So I think... we really need to see more people with scientific training taking on these outreach roles and writing for newspapers and informing policymakers and just getting people with scientific training out there doing things other than science. I mean, we see this with teaching. Teaching's one of those amazingly influential roles that a person can have, and it's one thing I've noticed is that people doing science degrees often view teaching as plan B.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame, because ideally you'd want people that actually care about teaching and feel really passionate about it. And so they see science teaching as their main priority. And sadly, what we see is people thinking, oh, well, you know, can't get a job doing actual science, and I'll just fall back on teaching. And I don't know, I have nothing to back up what I'm about to say, but I feel like maybe we end up with teachers that just don't really care about what they're doing or aren't the most effective science teachers. And so it just has these sort of long-term effects on science literacy in our population.
You mentioned back in high school that you didn't have any science teacher that kind of influenced you. And just on that, the fact that you probably didn't think they had the enthusiasm and passion. So who was a role model in your life?
In science-wise?
Well, basically, what made you decide to take up a marine biology degree of sorts?
Well, I mean, probably sounds stupid, but people like David Attenborough.
Oh, yes.
You know, even though I didn't realize I was interested in science at the time, as a kid, I was just constantly watching all those natural history documentaries and was quite obsessive about it. And so that really influenced me. Then, you know, once I started working in science and doing study, again, it was those people that showed genuine just passion and investment in what they did. It wasn't necessarily the most, you know, crash hot flashy scientists that were doing amazing things that really drove me to be a scientist. It was just meeting other people that were so passionate and having their passion just, you know, infuse within me and make me want to do the same sort of thing.
Yeah, fantastic. I think that's what we need, just the enthusiasm. It doesn't have to be polished presentations.
Yeah, that's a big problem, I think, with science communications. Everybody thinks we have to sound really smart and professional and
yeah,
want to be taken seriously. And with that, you lose some of the unbridled passion. You know, I want to hear people squealing giddily about the snail that they found. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just sometimes, I guess when you produce something on TV or something similar like that, it has to be really high quality or very much polished. I mean, David Attenborough, I mean, he's a great example of a presenter. I mean, I obviously haven't got a background in biology, but he has opened the world to me in terms of what's out there in the natural world. And he has a passion to raise the awareness of sort of the protection of the earth.
Because he's, to say the same sort of thing about your field, I mean, I think Commander Chris Hadfield has sort of had that effect for astronomy and for space. You know, it's not these sort of rigid military astronaut types. Here's a guy, you know, playing around with goop in space and playing David Bowie, and it's that, you know, what you get from Chris Hadfield is just the joy that he finds in doing the amazing things that he does. You know, we can all be impressed by how intelligent and articulate and committed he is, but just the joy he takes in it is really what makes the difference there.
Yeah, totally agree. So just enthusiasm, passionate, and I guess it's infectious as well. And so you obviously caught that so-called disease of actually wanting to pursue science, in particular biology, in that sense. So you're now back here at Macquarie University, doing similar research with the praying mantis, or?
So it's one of those things that you, as a scientist, you do tons of different things, but you always get remembered for that one thing. And so, yeah, I'm sort of become the orchid mantis guy, but I'm working on tons of different projects. I guess my main focus is understanding how animals perceive the world around them and how they emit what we call signals and cues. You know, think about an animal, it's giving off all sorts of information through, you know, what colors it has, what sounds it makes, what behaviors it does, and there are other animals that are taking in all that information, and I have to, you know, compute that information with their eyes and ears and brains. So I'm trying to figure out how those interactions happen and what effects it has on the lives that they live.
Fantastic.
And that makes sense. That sounded kinda really complicated. So, well, I mean, for example, one of the things I'm working on at the moment is ants. Ants pick up and disperse tree seeds. So there are these tree seeds that have little food rewards on them. It's a little fatty blob on the side of the tree seed, and that's full of all fatty acids that ants eat. So they just pick up that seed, take it down into their nests where they cache all their foods, and they're essentially planting tree seeds.
Oh, wow.
What's even cooler is that there are stick insects that do the exact same thing. There are stick insects that lay eggs, and on the eggs is a little blob that has lots of rich fatty acids in it. And so I want to know, do the ants think that they're a tree seed? Or do they just think it's a food reward? And then what sort of impact does that tiny little behavioral interaction have on the lives of the ants, but on also the lives of the stick insects? So using these tiny little questions about how animals are perceiving information, you can then ask much, much broader questions about how these animals live, how they've evolved over the millennia.
That's actually quite fascinating. I mean, I can understand how you find it very interesting, but say if a person from the street, you just said that to them, they go, why do you want to study that? What's the benefit for humanity in that sense when we come back to the original sort of thrust for sort of getting it out there?
I don't know if you come across this doing astronomy, but as soon as people find out you're a scientist and want to know what you're working on, they immediately want you to justify why you're worthwhile. And I mean, I don't ask that of hairdressers. I don't ask that of an accountant. Go to my friend that, works in admin in a hospital and go, what are you contributing to society? Hey,
you might get a really stern look there. Yeah. Help running a hospital here.
I mean, we're contributing to the knowledge base of mankind, and we're making contributions to our knowledge that will have impacts hundreds, thousands of years from now. I'm sorry if that's not enough for you.
Well, yeah, I guess we get similar questions in astronomy, not as much, because it's easier to sell astronomy to the public, because it's like, ooh, pretty pictures, and ooh, aliens, ooh, and all this other stuff.
Really? You're going to sell it with aliens?
Well, we don't need to sell it. Everyone just is fascinated by that. Oh, is there alien life out there? That's a common question that we get. And it's more than likely that there is, but less likely to meet them in our lifetime. We might find forms of life. You might be interested in this, in biological life on Mars itself. And so the idea for me, how we can connect in fields, is that a biologist can come in to actually answer, can a animal or some sort of living thing exist on Mars? And hence a field has been created, which is astrobiology. When the first field came into play, it was actually it was sort of laughed out of the room. But now it's actually done some serious science, and it's actually part of all the scientific disciplines. So maybe you can actually get your research ideas into astronomy as well. Become an astrobiologist.
See, I wonder why it seems to be a natural history thing or a biology thing that, you can say to someone that we're looking for, signs of life in outer space, and immediately that people can appreciate that because it affects our perception of who we are in the universe. I feel like studying life on Earth achieves the same thing, getting our head around the diversity of organisms that exist. It immediately impacts how we view our own evolutionary history and the world that we live in.
Yeah, it's the big questions we're answering, I think. Well, you're having your small part, but it's actually contributing to the bigger picture of who we are. And I guess that's what I like about astronomy, especially with planet formation, is what I'm part of now, is figuring out how did the planet Earth come into being? I mean, trying to still figure that out. I mean, we've got a general idea, but working out the details, because it's something you might have missed. Like if you want to recreate your own solar system, if we ever had that technology, at least we've researched it. However million years ago back, and we go, oh, we've got these knowledge. These humans in the 21st century came up with these ideas, and we can apply all our knowledge there. That'll be very interesting.
If we're going to be honest, though, I mean, it's not like I get up in the morning and go, right, I'm going to affect the future knowledge base of mankind. It's really, I just like asking questions, like exploring. I like doing things that have never been done, I guess. Whenever you do an experiment, you're doing something that has never been done before. You're asking a question that nobody's ever thought to ask before. And, you know, when I'm observing an animal behavior for the first time, you start to think to yourself, am I the first person in history to have ever seen this occur?
Yeah.
And that's really nice and rewarding. And really, it's, you know, the reason we do science is sometimes just selfishly because of that.
Yeah. When you do research like that, it is selfish. But also, we feel as though it's contributing to the bigger picture. Mm. And I guess, as communicators, we like to share that with everybody else. Mm. And so, podcast is the one way of actually doing that. And so, since being here with your postdoc, you've actually started up In Situ Science. Is that
yes.
Right? Can you talk about that? Because we're kind of doing kind of back-to-back episodes between Stempunk and In Situ. So. Yep.
So In Situ Science has a podcast. We're making short videos about science and putting up blog posts every now and again. And it's all about seeing science in practice, really. You know, one of the things that I really find fascinating about science is the stories of how it happens. You know, whenever you go on to popular science blogs and read popular science magazines, you're hearing all about the amazing discoveries that are made. And that's great, but for every discovery, there's years and years of work and people's lives that go into this incredible discovery. And it's a real shame that we never get to hear those stories. And, you know, even just in your own work, you know, the stuff that goes on in the lab and in your travels to communicate science, you know, there's amazing things happening. So on In Situ Science, or the podcast, we're just talking to different scientists in each episode and getting them to know them, and kind of like what we're doing here.
Yep.
And in the videos, we're following scientists out into the field or into the laboratory and actually seeing how science is done, and sort of breaking down that barrier so you can actually see the steps that go into making a discovery.
Hmm, fantastic. So you got a way of like a website that people can go to get all this stuff?
So it's just insituscience.com. In situ is spelled I-N-S-I-T-U, I suppose I should clarify that.
Yeah.
On Twitter, at In Situ Science. It's on YouTube. It's the videos are now going up on the RIOS Science channel.
Oh, yes.
So you can check them out there. And yeah, it's we're just starting off, so expect to see more things happening soon.
Yeah, so hopefully with this collaboration,
yeah,
we can actually increase our, what do we call it, viewership? No, listenership? I don't know. Something.
I think listenership's a word. I've heard that before.
Yeah, or tuners in, I don't know, podcasters.
Listeners.
Listeners.
Increase our
listeners. Sure there's a technical word out there. Well, maybe
audience.
We can just make one out.
We have an audience.
We have audience membership. Because they got to sign up, subscribe and everything like that.
Yeah,
so
subscribe to the podcast.
I don't want to mention how many subscribers we have at the moment, but we'd like to actually increase that number quite substantially. I'm sure you guys want to do the same. So. Fantastic. As well as being a scientist and a great communicator, you're a big fan of Eurovision.
Yes.
So did you like the fact that Australia was in Eurovision for the past 2 years now?
So I should clarify that this was a compulsory requirement of working with Mariella Herberstein, who is my PhD supervisor.
Ah.
She runs a Eurovision blog.
Oh.
And hosts Eurovision parties every year. And it was a compulsory requirement of being a student that we get involved with this. So every year, all of the members of the Behavioral Ecology Research Group have to write reviews of Eurovision songs. And there's a Eurovision morning tea that Mariella puts on. So you can check that out. I think it's thescienceofeurovision.wordpress.com.
Okay,
like
I'll look that up and link that in.
Or you can just read reviews of Eurovision songs written by evolutionary biologists.
Fantastic.
But yeah, I thought, what's her name? Dami Im this year?
Yes.
Who really should have won, let's face it.
Oh, right, okay. Yes.
Well, she won the judges' vote? No, the...
Yes, the official judges, but not the popular vote.
Yeah, which we all know is rigged, obviously. Well, no, it was political because it was Ukraine that won it this year.
Yes.
And that made the Russians very unhappy.
Mm. But Ukraine did a good performance, I think.
Oh, it was a great song.
Yeah.
Because it had a... There's Eurovision rules where your song can't be political. And this referred to... I think the song was called 1949 or something. It was some attack on Ukraine by Russians. And so the Russians were trying to get it banned because it was political. And the Eurovision committee said, no, it's historical. Oh. So they're going to let it fly.
So it's not current politics.
No. And so I think everybody just sort of decided to give the finger to Russia and all voted for Ukraine. And it was still a great song.
Yeah.
But I don't know. People say that Australia couldn't win Eurovision because then it would have to be hosted in Australia.
Well, do you know what would happen? There's actually official ruling on that.
My guess is they'd have to hold it at the Australian embassy somewhere. Because then they'd do it in Australian soil.
If you do some... Because I'm a bit of a Eurovision fan.
Oh, really?
But I like finding out these details. It turns out it hasn't really been spoken about. But if Australia does win, they have to nominate a country within Europe.
Oh, okay.
Right? Or the committee actually nominates a country. It won't be hosted in Australia if Australia happens to win. They made that as a clause. And so we'll probably no doubt get something like Great Britain, although they've succeeded in Scotland. So that will probably what would happen.
All right.
More likely. So it hasn't happened, but they've got something in place. And I think some people are going to, some Eurovision fans are going, why they're not part of Europe? But then you look at countries like Israel. All right. They've got the license. I mean, if Israel won it, would Israel host it?
Mm.
Right? It's close.
I hope Australia continues. I've been really surprised at how Australia has done in Eurovision. I was very, very skeptical when they announced Guy Sebastian.
Yes.
I've signed the petition to send TISM to Eurovision.
Oh, okay.
You don't remember TISM?
No. Explain TISM. I'm not up with that.
they had a great song called Greg the Stop Sign. They're a sort of late 90s punk band. They all wore, I don't know, black suits and balaclavas. You couldn't see their face.
Oh, yeah. That will go down well. Yeah.
And so I was all for that. And then they set up Guy Sebastian and went, oh, this is going to be a disaster. Mm. And then he was great. He was really good.
He was actually pretty good.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then Dami was the same. So.
Yeah, she did even better because we were in the semis for this year.
Oh, the guy was in the finals as well.
What I mean was that Demi had to go through the semis and to get to the final.
Oh.
We were officially in the final already as a wild card entry. So you got the five standard countries that are automatically in the final, and the sixth country is the host country. We were the seventh honorary guest be automatically in the final. Yeah. But we came fifth overall, which is pretty good. But then we blew everything out of the water and came second. So that was pretty impressive performance there.
Yeah.
So who knows what next year will bring. Is it next year, this year?
Next year, yeah.
Next year, May, that's May? Right. Yeah, yep. That's when it typically happens. That's pretty cool. One last thing I'd like to sort of discuss you before we actually ask a final question from Brian Schmidt, who we've got coming in a moment, is your photos on your website are quite impressive. Do you fancy yourself a bit of a amateur photographer of sorts?
Very amateur, yes. Yeah. It's a really good hobby to have, I think. And it works well with being a field biologist because you get to spend lots of time out in the field. And I guess I like the challenge of it. Like, I wouldn't say I'm that polished a photographer, but I just like going out somewhere and it's weird light coming in from a strange angle and it's misty and it's about to rain and your animals are moving and you just stick your camera in manual mode and you've got to try and figure out the best combination of things to get that shot.
Aperture size, focal length.
Yeah.
I find myself a bit of an amateur photographer myself. So.
And I don't know, whenever you go out in a day and it's perfectly sunny and your animals are sitting perfectly still, I never find myself taking good photos. They're always really dull and boring. I think it's because I just have no idea what I'm doing. But whenever you're in that difficult situation that you can, you know, working within those restrictions allows you to be creative.
Yeah.
And you can end up with some interesting photos.
And you do have some really good ones on your site there.
Thank you.
Pretty cool. Maybe we can talk later about tips and so.
Sounds good.
All good. All right. So this is probably the first time we've actually putting this in our Stempunk podcast, is asking our previous guest a question to ask the next guest. So our last guest was Nobel laureate and ANU VC Brian Schmidt. And he's got a question for you. He didn't know it was you, but you're our next guest.
Sorry, Brian.
and hopefully you got a bit of time, because I've given you the question beforehand
and
got a bit of time to hopefully think about it, is how do we get girls to become computer scientists?
Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, before I worked back at Macquarie, I worked for a little while at Code Club, which is an organization that tries to get computer coding introduced into primary schools. And I was managing their outreach for them. So I was organizing lots of public events and going out to schools and putting on events. And so there was lots of time engaging with kids and introducing them to coding. And I mean, this is just my impression, but overwhelmingly, I think that the girls excelled with it and they just really enjoyed it. And naturally took to it. I don't know if it was the particular environment that they were put in, or the fact that it was presented to them in a way that was very creative and problem solving. But I felt like girls at the primary school age really, really appreciated really the contemplative and problem solving side of computer coding. Whereas boys at the primary school age were more interested in farting and punching each other and that sort of stuff. I mean, that's not a black and white thing, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was just the impression that I got. So something then is going to be happening at, you know, maybe the teenage age, where coding just becomes undesirable, maybe. And if I want to be deeply philosophical about this, I'm going to, you know, say that maybe it has something to do with self-esteem and perception at that age, and that maybe, you know, girls and boys are, you know, as all teenagers are, trying to fit in and don't want to be seen as the odd one out and don't want to be, I don't know, isolated or different in some sort of way. And maybe that's what's sort of driving this wedge between boys and girls and who takes up programming at that age. So I think if we can improve the self-esteem of young girls and improve their confidence, empower them at that age, then they'll just have the confidence to do what they love and stick with what they love, and hopefully that will, in, you know, facilitate them to strive in these fields where they are able to contribute so much and at the moment are sadly missed.
Hmm. So it's a cultural thing, certainly. Yes. And probably I think it also goes for both boys and girls, in a sense that I think teachers and parents play a huge role in influencing the decisions. Because unfortunately, preconception ideas about girls are over here and boys are over here, if we do away with all that right from a young age, you say put them all together in one room, let them experience everything at once, and so try and dispel misconceptions about a girl should be doing this or a boy should be doing it. It should be both ways. Because I often hear, especially with the probably the older generation now, rather than the younger generations, it's coming up a bit better. But I hear stories that when I took it, like an elderly lady says, when I took an interest in science, she was suppressed, and then she, you wouldn't be able to handle that. Too complicated. That's a boy's thing to do. So she ended up doing all the girl stuff, whatever that really meant. To me, that seems preposterous. I mean, the girl stuff apparently at that time was go learn about cooking, go look about sort of the washing clothes and all that kind of stuff. Go work in the kitchen, so to speak, which I was just flabbergasted. Because I would never say that to anybody, because you choose what you want to do. I mean, house chores for me is just an everyday part of life. And it's just like, because I grew up where Well, I guess my mum told me, yeah, do your chores, else you won't get food. Or no, you wouldn't get food, else you won't get your pocket money, so to speak. But that was a bit of a different thing. But I guess I like to see that we shouldn't discriminate no matter what. Because as you say, there's actually both boy and girls that are very passionate about what they do. And it just comes out in different ways. And I think as people, we should be able to recognize those different things and encourage them no matter what.
Yeah.
Sorry, I took over a bit there.
Said it better than I could.
Oh, right. There you go. Cool. So I also asked you, is there a potential question to ask our next guest?
Yeah.
And have you thought of a question?
Yeah, I was going to bring it back to what we were talking about before about justifying sheer exploration. You know, we're hearing lots about science at the moment and how... We're hearing lots about innovation and how it's there to help industry and all that sort of stuff. I'm sort of the opinion that that's going to pigeonhole science a lot. I think science is... Things like science and art are at their best when there is freedom to explore without, you know, a perceived objective in mind. So I guess I would ask the next person how they would justify sheer exploration, the intellectual equivalent of sailing into uncharted waters. How can you justify that to your friends and family and funding bodies and universities?
Wow, that's a pretty loaded question. And there'll be a very interesting answer associated with that, I bet. And yeah, I feel sorry for the person who can answer that. But I'm sure they'll have some interesting
insight. I'm asking because I haven't got a good answer for myself yet.
Well, but it's an interesting discussion question. Definitely. I think that's the main point. And I think that's a very good question to ask. So, Dr. James O'Hellen,
yes.
Thank you very much for being a guest on our STEM Punk podcasting.
It's been lots of fun.
Yeah, pleasure. Until next time.